I'm honored to welcome Michael Parenti to UVM tonight. Michael will speak on the topic, The Hidden Ideology of Mass Media. For those who do not know his work, Dr. Parenti is a nationally known lecturer and scholar, author of numerous books and articles, a political analyst, and a radical activist. Michael was the target of a political firing by the UVM Board of Trustees in the academic year 1971-72, precisely 25 years ago this year. It was an extraordinary overturning of the usual procedures for academic reappointment. For the first and only time in UVM's history, the trustees overrode the entire university evaluation process and refused to reappoint, is the euphemism they used, Parenti for failing to display what they called professional conduct, a requirement the trustees themselves had invented after the fact to justify their decision to fire him. Michael had the support of his colleagues in the political science department, the Arts and Sciences College, and the University Senate. Administratively, he was supported by his department chairperson, by the college dean, and by the president of the university. Still, the trustees, who lacked any serious academic credentials, took it upon themselves to remove one of the most popular professors and published scholars on the campus. All the instances of so-called unprofessional conduct which the trustees gave as reasons for their actions were constitutionally protected acts of free speech. Let me give you an example of some of the kinds of reasons they gave. Michael was the invited speaker at a Rotary Club function in town and was speaking on the subject of liberty and justice for all. When the meeting began, I'm not even sure if Michael knew that it was going to happen, a pledge to allegiance was said, and Michael stood respectfully and then explained as part of his talk that the reason he hadn't pledged is because the claim of liberty and justice for all was not yet true, and when it was true, he'd be happy to take the pledge, and until that time, he'd fight like hell to make it true. That was the kind of reason the trustees gave. Let me give you another, just so you have a flavor of the event. In 1971, 15 of us on the campus filed suit against the state of Vermont and the university for the teacher's loyalty oath. There was and is in Vermont a loyalty oath that only teachers are required to take, in which they're required to swear their loyalty to the constitutions of Vermont and the United States. Many of us in the early 70s thought this was a holdover from the McCarthy era that should be challenged, so we filed suit. Former Governor Hoff was our ACLU-appointed attorney, and the case was going very well until the Nixon Supreme Court ruled in favor of an even more draconian and restrictive loyalty oath in the state of Florida, thereby blowing our case out of the water here in federal court in Vermont. So we all signed our loyalty oaths, but attached long qualifying statements about the contradictions and difficulties we thought were involved in forcing loyalty, a rather bizarre notion in itself. Michael was cited as failing to take his teacher's loyalty oath without putting a qualifying statement on it as one of the reasons for firing him. They also accused him of carrying a Viet Cong flag in a demonstration on Church Street. As Michael pointed out in his response to them, he didn't know what a Viet Cong flag was, but he did carry a National Liberation Front flag on Church Street, and that was his constitutionally protected right, as the Supreme Court had ruled several years earlier. So the trustees were clearly simply looking around for pretexts under which to get someone off campus who impugned their interests as members of the corporate elite and who demystified the nature of U.S. foreign policy as what it actually was, U.S. imperialism in the war in Vietnam at the time. UVM was placed under censure by the American Association of University Professors after the trustees moved to fire Michael. The American Political Science Association also put the university under censure. An international legal defense fund was established on his behalf by academics across the United States, as well as Europe and Canada. The case received national press attention from the Boston Globe to Time magazine to the New York Times. In response, some of the UVM faculty pledged to create the Thomas Jefferson Chair of Critical Studies to keep Michael on campus. That is, we pledged enough funds to pay his salary until the legal battle could be won and we wouldn't have to lose him from the campus and as our colleague. However, UVM's President Andrews caved in to pressure from the trustees and refused to allow Michael's courses to be taught on the campus or to be granted credit. It was a very sad day in the history of the university and a dismal episode in the struggle for academic and political freedom. While UVM recanted its firing in 1954 of Alex Novikoff for his refusal to testify and name names before a witch-hunting congressional committee, in the course of recanting that, they gave Novikoff an honorary degree and formally apologized to him in 1983. With respect to Michael's firing, however, the university has been noticeably silent. In the official history, the University of Vermont, the first 200 years, published in 1991, the Parenti case is barely mentioned, though the Nowakoff case gets an entire chapter. And what little mention there is either seriously incomplete or woefully inaccurate, where it mentions him at all. Dr. Parenti's return on the 25th anniversary of his firing will serve to remind members of the community how much we lost when the trustees went beyond their intended institutional role as financial advisors to the university and decided that certain ideas they found personally distasteful were not to be part of the universe of free discourse on this campus. The Parenti firing was a watershed event in UVM's history. Instead of opposing the trustees by whatever means were necessary, the faculty allowed itself to be sidelined by, quote, waiting for it to be settled in the courts, unquote, which is how the administration spun the issue at the time. After the firing of Parenti, the way was cleared to remove other left, anti-war, and radical faculty who, as younger faculty, had fewer academic publications and credentials than Michael did. A purge of the philosophy department was begun by the same administration that had been called to task by the trustees for forcing them to fire Michael themselves. The lesson the administration learned was they better do the firing for the trustees so the trustees didn't have to come out in the open and do it themselves. A philosophy department chair was hired, again in an unprecedented way, over a 9-to-1 vote against him by the members of the philosophy department at that time. And he was hired explicitly to fire as many people in the department as he could. The new chairman then began to fire or force out nearly the entire department, full and part-time members. Doug Bailey, Julia Bailey, Nancy Ford, Bob Rice, Jerry Anderson, who's here in the audience tonight, and Jim Corcoran, Bill Beckett, Jerry Swanson, and finally even Josepina Mineta, the only abstention in the vote against hiring the chair who did the firing, was herself driven out. After having learned from the Parenti case, the administration gave no reasons at all for firing the philosophers, so that it would be much harder to litigate against them. They had learned in Michael's case that if you gave reasons, you might be suable. If you gave no reasons at all, it was easier to get away with it. Before the decade ended of the 1970s, Howard Waitzkin, a radical sociologist and physician, was fired, and Ralph Underhill, another radical sociologist, was fired in 1979. And all were casualties of the campaign to narrow the range of ideas, theories, and critique that could safely take place in a sustained discussion at UVM. The slamming shut of the academic job market in the mid-1970s and the continuing production of PhDs by those institutions and faculty that didn't want to lose their cheap labor graduate assistants created an immense reserve army of unemployed PhDs. With crowds of unemployed academics waiting outside the gates of universities, it was easy to clean house, in quotes, of all those who held unorthodox or radical ideas. The corporate managerial system has intensified its invasion and occupation of universities and colleges, bringing them more and more under the dominion of corporate imperatives, especially with the public defunding of higher education in the last 15 years. The demoralization and fear engendered at UVM by this repression persists today. Indeed, one psychologist on our faculty suggested several years ago that most of our faculty are clinically depressed. To add insult to injury, after years of managing by demoralization, some administrators have now been heard to complain about the high cost of mental health services for UVM employees. Well, the cure for depression often requires focusing your anger appropriately at someone else. I propose that we honor Michael Parenti tonight by taking up the struggle he was blacklisted at UVM for a quarter of a century ago. In the lobby, there are several letters that faculty and community members can sign in support of, first, UEUVM, the staff union organizing effort that's currently going on. There's also a sign-up list for faculty who finally recognize that it's time for us to organize our own union. I'd appreciate your signing that list so we can begin our networking activity. And finally, there's a letter that all can sign concerning calling on the UVM president and trustees to confer on Michael the apology and honorary degree that they gave Alexander Novikov 14 years ago. Even if in Michael's case, it's far too little, far too late. I'm proud to present to you tonight, Michael Parenti. Thank you.
you. It's really, really nice to be here. Has it really been 25 years? You know, it's very depressing, isn't it, Will, that the children of your students are now your students. Isn't that right? On the other hand, it's very inspiring to know that we have another whole generation and the struggle goes on and continues. And that's what really bothers the powers that be, that they have to deal with these human beings who have thoughts and interests of their own. And that's always a problem. One of the great assets they have on their side is the media. Yes, the title is The Hidden Ideology of the News Media, or the Mass Media. But it's so well hidden that the media themselves will maintain they don't have an ideology. They report only the truth. We goes out there, we gets the story, and we writes it. That's how a reporter said it to me. They have no selectivity, no biases. So you have these two basic myths. One is that it's a free and independent press. Two is that it's an objective press. You also have a third one, which has become a predominant one, reflective of the conservative domination of the media, namely that it's a liberal media. The idea, the charge that the media is biased in a liberal way, is well known to most Americans. The charge I'm going to make tonight that the media is biased in a right-wing corporate America way is a view not as well known, which itself, you see, bespeaks of the bias of the media. The reason the first is so well known is because that's what the conservatives want you to know. The reason they're able to get you to know it is because they so dominate the media. They so dominate the media that they can convince you that it's the liberals who dominate the media. Did you get that? I haven't lost anybody yet. All right? It's too early in the talk to lose you. Let's actually look at the media. One of the remarkable things about the commentators in the media is they go from far right to moderate center. You have the Rush Limbaughs, the Bob Inises, the Bob Grants, or whatever their names are, the shock jocks. You've got the McLaughlins. McLaughlin has three shows on television. John McLaughlin, this gruff right-winger National Review editor. You have William Buckley, who has The Evening with David Brinkley. You have Evans and Novak and others and others. You get a range of discussion that goes from far right, as I say, to a pale, skittish, centrist, moderate, liberal view, which is always kind of dressing itself up on the right. Rush Limbaugh has, for instance, 600 radio stations. Ralph Nader, who was around 25 years before Rush Limbaugh, who had done nationally known investigative work, his commentaries get on very few radio stations. He has a newspaper column he writes that gets into 20 newspapers. Conservative columnists, their columns are syndicated on an average of 200 to 450 newspapers around the country. So that's the way it goes. There are well-financed right-wing media watch organizations. Reed Irvine. Now, Reed Irvine I've debated a couple of times on panels, and he keeps talking about liberal media and how conservative views are shut out of the media. So you've got all these conservatives all over the media talking about a liberal media. And if you call up and you say, what's so liberal about it when they got people like you all over it? Actually, stations are awash with your commentaries. Irvine, for instance, I said conservative viewpoints are shut out of the media. You have a radio show that's aired on 120 stations. He said, 200. His ego was such that he was actually strengthening my argument when he wanted to get the right number. I said, you have a newspaper column that appears in over 90 newspapers. He says, it's 100. I said, well, there's a lot of us on the left, us liberal, progressive, left, radical, Marxist, whatever, all the various variations. A lot of us would love to be shut out in that manner. We really would. Not to be overlooked is the National Empowerment Television, or NET. It's a new cable network. It's available in all 50 states. It offers round-the-clock conservative political commentary nonstop. Newt Gingrich has a show. Hey, there's one you don't want to miss. In the words of its founder, Paul Weyrich, NET is dedicated to countering media news that is riddled with a far-left political bias and unacceptable notions about gender norming, racial quotas, global warming, and gays in the military. These are the mortal dangers that he's facing. I'll quote you David Bergen. David Bergen is editor-in-chief of the Oakland Tribune, out near where I live in the Bay Area, California now. And this is what Bergen says. And this is very interesting because this comes from an editor-in-chief of a mainstream newspaper. And he says, the greatest myth in America, or one of the top five at least, is the notion of the liberal press. That is such a crock. By the way, one thing about some newsmen is that you're impressed by their eloquence of phrasing. That is such a crock. And the media bashing based on this so-called liberalness, Bergen goes on, that guys like Limbaugh get away with attacking. You know what? In all the years I've worked for newspapers, and the total is 18 or 19 of them, I have never worked for a liberal newspaper. Not one. There's only a half dozen in the entire country. There are some 1,700 daily newspapers, and they're all run by Republicans. Why? Because Republicans are the kind of people who own things. He left out a variable there. The rich are the kind of people who own things, and they tend to be Republican. That's why. And I don't know one of them who's going to let some liberal run his newsroom. It ain't going to happen. Well, who owns the big media, the mainstream media that reaches millions of people? The press lords who come to mind are right-wing conservatives, or moderately right, maybe. William Randolph Hearst, Henry Luce, Rupert Murdoch, who describes himself not as a conservative, but as a radical conservative, meaning a very extreme, tense conservative, Sulzberger, Annenberg, people of markedly conservative hue, who, by the way, leave their ideological imprint on the editorial news. Sulzberger used to call up the editorials for the next morning that were going to go in the New York Times, and he would go into them. He's the publisher, right, and directly going in and interfering, and sometimes even on the front page. His son is taken over, punches, the old man is retired, the young one is even more conservative. He says he meets with his editorial board every day. Rupert Murdoch, who probably owns more media in the world than any other individual, owns almost all the media of Australia, was an Australian, came to the U.S., found there were restrictive laws against how much media a non-U.S. citizen can own, so he became a citizen within a month. Most people have to wait a number of years, you know, green card, residency, all that stuff. He got it like that, and owns enormous numbers of newspapers and TV stations. He was interviewed once. Interview was carried in Vanity Fair. The question was, you're considered to be politically conservative. To what extent do you influence the editorial posture of your newspapers? And I thought you'd get that usual blather about, well, of course, I respect the editorial integrity and independence and professionalism of my editors and blah, 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 blah. He didn't say anything like that. He responded with rather refreshing candor. He said, to what extent do I influence my editorial policies of my newspapers? Considerably. My editors have input, but I make the final decision. That's very refreshing, you know, when they come right out and they say what really happens. I do it, understand? You do what I say because I control your career, your job. And my control of your job and your salary gives me control of your mind, too. And if there's some kind of incongruity there and clash, then your mind goes out the door with your butt, you see. The boards of directors of print and broadcast news organizations are populated by representatives from Ford, General Motors, General Electric, General Dynamics, Dow Corning, Alcoa, Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, ITT, IBM, AT&T, and other corporations. So these boards are filled with the representatives of corporate America. That's your free and independent media. You see, the media in this country are not close to corporate America. They're not friendly to corporate America. They're not inclined or biased toward corporate America. They are corporate America. They are multinational giant corporations, and their boards are inhabited with the same people who inhabit the boards, these interlocking directorates who inhabit the boards of all the other giant corporations and come from these other corporations. Among the major stockholders of the three largest broadcast networks are Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan, and Citibank. NBC is owned by General Electric. CBS is owned by Tisch. ABC, Capital Cities, is owned by Disney. GE and Disney are the two most conservative corporations that exist. Fox Network is owned by Rupert Murdoch. What's a free independent media we're talking about. And these people appoint the presidents of the corporations, who appoint the bureau chiefs, who appoint the top editors, who appoint the reporters. If you look at the organization of any news organization, it looks like the army, top-down command right down along the way. And their profits are as high as anything in corporate America, and the degree of merger and concentration is higher than it is in finance capital and in manufacturing capital. The media are highly profitable, highly concentrated. Given that distribution of ownership, it's not surprising that labor is regularly downplayed, the concerns of labor. In this last election, for instance, you remember the AFL-CIO said, we're going to get political, we're going to go out there, and we are pledging, the story got around all the media, $35 million we will spend in the campaign. And suddenly the terms were being revised. Big labor is influencing, flexing its muscles in the campaign. They're going to spend $35 million. You could not have missed it. It turned out they spent about $25 million. But it was all over the media about big labor. Let me tell you something, folks, that in the state of California and in the state of Florida, there were corporations that spent $40, $50, $60 million in California to defeat a single-payer health program for the citizens of the state of California, in Florida to defeat protection of the wetlands and environmental laws. They spent more money to defeat little state propositions on the ballot in those states for a few propositions than labor spent in all over the country. But you wouldn't have known it. There were no big headlines about big capital. You heard about big labor. Did you hear about big capital spending 10 times more than anybody else? For both parties, buying politicians of all stripes and wedding them to their way. The concerns of labor are your concerns. They're the concerns of ordinary working people. They're the concerns about wages. They're the concerns about work conditions. They're the concerns about job opportunities. The concerns about consumer safety, occupational safety, environmental protection. Those are the things that labor unions, especially the more progressive labor unions, have been fighting for and talking about for years. You wouldn't know it. It's not in the business-owned media. You've got a business section. Go buy a newspaper tomorrow and pick up that newspaper. You'll find a business section for that 2, 3, 4% that own about 80% of the capital in America. Where's the labor section? Where's the labor news? Where are the concerns of working people? Jonathan Tassini, head of the National Writers Union, my union, I'm a member of it. I'm a writer, I thought I'd unionize, why not? I believe in it. He studied all reports dealing with workers' issues carried by ABC, CBS, NBC, Evening Television News, during one whole year. And he defined labor issues rather widely. It included a few consumer issues and child care issues. It came to only 2.3% of total coverage. We're not even talking about how they were covered, just that there was even any mention. 2.3% of the total news coverage was for labor's issues. For that 120 million people who work for a living, 140 million, whatever it is now. No wonder another survey found that only 6% of business leaders in America thought that media treatment accorded them was poor, while 66% said it was good or excellent. Another influence on the media, a conservative influence, are the corporate advertisers. They exercise a considerable influence. Todd Gitlin interviewed these network bosses and said, to what extent was entertainment TV? So to what extent do your advertisers influence your decisions regarding what you put in your programs? And again, I thought you'd hear the usual blather of, well, it can be a pressure occasionally, but that's the exception. We have our individual standards and all that. Every one of them said, all the time. To what extent? We always keep them guys. Are you kidding? Those are our accounts. Are you kidding? They pay the bills all the time. You bet you. We watch out all the time as to what bothers them or doesn't bother them. In fact, a lot of our programming isn't for you, it is to please our advertiser. It's not to please the public, necessarily. And often the advertiser does come in and threatens and cancels accounts, not generally because their product is being poorly reflected, but more often because they perceive that there are liberal tendencies creeping into news reports and commentaries or into the particular shows, whatever else. Religious media manifests the same imbalance. How many of us have heard of the Christian Right? I bet everybody has. They have a whole network, the Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN, Pat Robertson. They have several $1 billion worth of media. They have hundreds of radio stations. 10% of all radio outlets in America are controlled by the Christian right-wingers. 14% of the nation's television stations are owned and controlled by the Christian right-wingers. Have you ever heard of a Christian left? There happens to be a very substantial Christian left in America, liberation theology, people who believe in progressive reform, people who believe that the word of Christ means the social gospel, that you live Christ out in the street, that you find and you work with other people in need and you work for social justice. Where are they? They don't own any networks. That's right, because big money doesn't back a Christian right. They consider them communist, a Christian left, I'm sorry. They consider a Christian left communistic. Big money backs the Christian right and gets them out there in the media, and those are the people who are heard, those are the people who get the subscriptions, those are the people who then rally the souls. A favorite conservative hallucination is that the public broadcasting system, PBS, is a leftist stronghold. There are a few occasionally good documentaries on PBS, although two of the very best that I can recall, which won Academy Awards, Deadly Deception and Panama Deception, both won Academy Awards for full-length documentary features, have never appeared on PBS except one or two local stations. In fact, more than 70% of PBS's primetime shows are funded either completely or in major part by four giant oil companies. No wonder we often refer to PBS as standing for Petroleum Broadcasting System. PBS public affairs programs are underwritten. Remember, you know when they say our underwriters? You watch PBS, don't you, occasionally? You know, our underwriters are. This is such a genteel term. They mean advertisers. Our filthy rich corporate advertisers are. They don't want to come right out and say that. Are. General Electric, General Motors, Metropolitan Life, PepsiCo, Mobil, Payne Weber, Exxon, and the like. A study of these shows by one media watchdog group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, found that corporate representatives constituted 44% of the sources about the economy. Public interest advocates accounted for 3%, while labor representatives were virtually shut out and non-existent. Another thing is the appearance of false diversity, I would call it. I think I call it, in Inventing Reality, I call it false balancing. You can watch a talk show or a panel, and there'll be two, three, four people. You watch Nightline, he says, we have so-and-so from here, we have so-and-so from there, and they'll get into arguments with each other, and you can sit there, and you are being reassured, you see, there is openness and diversity in our media, difference of opinion. I heard a debate one time on the David Brinkley show. It was between, one of them was Elliot Abrams, and I forget who the other guy was. Abrams was in the State Department, he wasn't in the Pentagon, so it wasn't Abrams, it was that guy named Perez. And I forget the other fellow's name. One of them was arguing that the escalated level of defense spending under the Reagan administration, up to $300 billion, almost $300 billion a year, was sufficient, and the escalation was a good thing. The other one was arguing that the escalation was a good thing, but we should escalate even more and spend still more in defense spending. So those were the two sides of the argument. And it reminds you that, you know, when you hear two sides of an argument, you're not hearing all sides of an argument. And so again, you see, that whole other part of the spectrum, that whole public interest, progressive left part, has been amputated and thrown out of the picture. Crossfire is a very good example. Michael Kinsley against Pat Buchanan. And Michael Kinsley had a moment of truth. He said something that was very, very true. He said as follows. If you watch Crossfire, they say, on the left, Michael Kinsley. On the right, Pat Buchanan. They have new people now, I know. I try not to watch that show. I've been on it twice. It's a screaming feast, you know. You sit there and you got one conservative here screaming, you got the other one here screaming, and the left that day was Tom Brandon, who really looked almost like he was giving up the ghost. They'd just sit there and go, well, I don't know, gee. And the right was Robert Novak. And I finally turned to Robert Novak. I said, are you going to let me finish a sentence, or is this a screaming match? He said, you'll finish a sentence, but first we have to cut for commercial. You know? And this is the way it is. And try to develop a thought is impossible. So you just screaming, no, that's not true. Yes, it is. No, it is. And that sort of thing. This is what passes for discourse, for the universe of political discourse in a democratic citizenry. We're supposed to be informed and make up our minds about certain things looking at this kind of thing. Did I tell you what Kinsley said? Or I forgot. You're not the only one getting old.
We're all okay.
Kinsley made this point. He said, Buchanan is much further to the right than I am to the left. And that's exactly the point, you see. That what passes for the liberal or left opinion is really a skittish, very nervous, centrist position that's constantly dressing up its right, that's constantly worrying that it might not be seen as too far out here, which is not the right. The right goes as far right as it wants to go. So then even what passes for liberal opinion in the media must take place within a conservative framework. Not surprisingly, then, public discussion is heavily skewed to the right. On foreign affairs, the media's role as cheerleader of the national security state and free market capitalism is without restraint. Virtually no positive exposure has ever been given to an indigenous third world revolutionary or reformist struggles, or to protests at home and abroad against U.S. overseas interventions. U.S. military undertakings in the Vietnam War, the invasion of Grenada and Panama, the Reagan intervention against Nicaragua, the Gulf War massacre, all these undertakings are portrayed as arising from noble, if sometimes perhaps misplaced, intentions. The whole critique, the whole debate during the Vietnam War, I remember, was between those people who said we could win the war and those people who said we couldn't win the war. See, now the assumption of the second was if we could, there'd be no argument then, you see. But there wasn't all of us, the millions of us who were out in the streets getting beaten up by the police, getting arrested and all other things, including me, the millions of us who said there shouldn't be a war, whether you could win it or lose it. And the horror of it was that you might even win it. That war was immoral. It was homicidal. It was killing hundreds of thousands of people. We now see 2 million Vietnamese died in that war. The United States killed 2 million Vietnamese. The Nazis killed, you know, millions of people. We see that as a horrible thing. This was seen in our media as well-intentioned struggle, but it went awry. The Vietnamese weren't ready for democracy, it seems. We tried to bring them democracy with those B-52s and napalm and rapid fire deployment forces and free fire zones and all that. But the damn fool people just didn't want to come to their senses. You've all heard about Bosnia, haven't you? Who hasn't heard about Bosnia? Raise your hand. Ah, see? Right back there. You could leave. Okay. How many has heard about Mozambique? You've heard about people dying in Bosnia. You've heard about people dying in Rwanda. Well, in Mozambique, there was something like 1 million people died. In Angola, there was something like 3 million in wars that were being fought, financed by the CIA. Not a word about it. The massive killings and slaughters that went on by mercenary forces throughout the country, the atrocities, unspeakable stuff, it went on for years. Within a six-month period, 600,000 people killed in Angola. Not a word about it, because the media didn't talk about it. So you see, they may not predetermine what you think, but what they do is they can prefigure what we think about. We talk about those things, maybe not exactly the way they might want us, but they seem to set the agenda for what we believe is important. And when you ask about all these other issues, they'll say, well, look, you know, we have a limited amount of time and space. We just can't cover everything. We have to be very selective and careful, and we've got to compress and condense things. Isn't that right? Haven't you noticed that selective, compressed, and condensed story just recently about the Heavenly Gate cult? Right? Wasn't that compressed and condensed? It was only about a week of 24 hours a day. We had interviews of relatives of friends who knew somebody who had been close to someone else who was in the cult. Interviews of stock boys who worked in stores where cult members had shopped in, they think, you know. Right? I mean, really, this is the media that doesn't have enough time to cover everything. And they went on and on and on about these things. Meanwhile, not a word about Mozambique. One of the ways in which the media serve as the stenographers for power, or the mouthpieces for power, is the way they so eagerly and quickly, as if on cue, demonize a foreign leader who might be targeted by U.S. military intervention. I'll give you three examples in recent years. By recent years, I mean from the 1980s and 1990s. Gaddafi of Libya, Noriega of Panama, and Saddam Hussein of Iraq. Now, what those three leaders had in common is, in their quite different ways, were charting a rather independent course for their country. These three guys were demonized within a matter of weeks, you know. Gaddafi, I remember, Libya. I'd go around talking, people would be Gaddafi, and what about Gaddafi, what about Gaddafi, Gaddafi, Gaddafi going to get your mama, Gaddafi under your bed, watch out, Gaddafi. I say, what are you preoccupied by Gaddafi? There's one reason you're preoccupied by Gaddafi. Not because he's a threat to you, but because the media has been pumping you with stories about him. 2 months ago when they weren't doing this, nobody was you weren't talking about Gaddafi. You were going to bed, going to sleep, had a nice night. You didn't worry if he was under your bed or not. Now you're Gaddafi. And when they stop talking about him, you'll stop worrying about him again. It's kind of scary. I remember that with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in Iraq by the CIA. He was a right-wing military guy. He exterminated the Kurdish Independent Party. He exterminated the Iraqi Communist Party. I mean, this guy was not particularly good news. But he also did some other things. He was developing the country. He trained a whole cadre of engineers. He put out education plans. And he was fighting for an independent course on the oil pricing. And that was his mistake. And Bush went after him. So we now find even a conservative nationalist, if he's an independent nationalist and doesn't act like a purely comprador ruler, that is, a ruler who is a client state leader of U.S. corporate American imperialism, the kind of ruler who says, come on in, boys, it's all yours, do what you want with the country, there's no development, there's no occupational safety laws, there's no minimum wage laws, there's no unions, or they're very small, very weak, if they get out of line, we'll beat the hell out of them with our civil guard, our guard who are trained, financed, equipped, and advised by you. And you come on in, invest in cheap labor, your profit level, your value-added level, the rates are 3-4 times what they'll be in Ohio or California. Close your factory there, come on here, open it up here, it's all yours. That's the kind of leaders they want. And when they get a leader who charts an independent course, and that's Noriega of Panama, he said, I got $10 million from the CIA. Noriega was CIA. It's no accident that Trujillo, his boss, the military leader who took over in Panama, and took back the Panama Canal, and then started all sorts of reforms, human service programs, education for the common people. It's no accident that less than a year after Reagan got into office, Trujillo's plane exploded in midair. A bomb blew him to pieces, and Noriega was put in his place. But Noriega still had, the Panamanian military was a rather progressive one, a nationalist, populist military, and there were limits to what he could do. And when he started refusing to do what the CIA want on drug deals and on anti-Sandinista moves, that's when they went after him. And the media report him as called him a jungle rat. I remember Dan Rathers, the liberal Dan Rathers, saying, Noriega, he called him a swamp rat. The swamp rat, Noriega, crafty and full of guile, like he's an expert on swamp rats. So you turn to your fellow Americans, you say, how could a country, Libya, a country with which a short time ago you couldn't even find on the map, headed by a guy whose name we still can't all agree on how to spell or even pronounce, with a population of 3 million, 3 million, and a ragtag army of 50,000, how can that country be a mortal threat to the survival and interests of the United States? It's not a mortal threat to us. It was a threat to the oil companies, that's all. His unspeakable sin was he and his colonels led a colonel's rebellion in 1968 in a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, our wonderful ally Saudi Arabia today. That is a country that had mass poverty and a few obscenely rich families that had hundreds of billions of dollars more money than knew what to do with. He took over that country and he started to use that money for social programs. 40 million trees planted in forestation programs, education programs, health clinics set up, roads put in, and the like. And he nationalized the oil industry. He took it from the big oil companies. He said, the oil is in our land. The people who live on this land should get something for it. He still sells the oil to us at relatively the same price. It's no loss to you and me. The loss is to Exxon and Mobil. Well, for half a century, the CIA and other covert agencies have involved themselves in political assassinations and death squads that have killed tens of thousands of people in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Bolivia, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, and you can go on. And the killings were not random. The killings were of liberation theology clergy, of union leaders, of student leaders, peasant leaders, co-op leaders, and people like this. Anybody who was doing anything to try to organize the ordinary, common, poor people to better their lives, become active social agents of their own lives, those were the people killed. And it's a very rational and very correct policy, because I, who make money and get rich off your labor, want you demoralized and disorganized. I don't want you organized. I don't want you well-educated. I don't want you conscious and informed and militant. I don't want you being able and capable of defending your own interests. The hungrier you are, the more willing you will work for harder and harder for less and less. And the harder you work for less and less, the more I make and the richer I make. For half a century, the CIA has been involved in drug trafficking and alliances. They were involved with the Golden Triangle. They had a whole airplane company. It was called Air America. Wasn't it Air America? It was a CIA-run airplane company directly involved with taking the heroin out and bringing it to that big, rich American market, the first one. Do you know which one that was? It was the GIs in Vietnam. You got 300,000 guys there living on the edge, desperate, bored, homesick, miserable, frightened, and with money. That's a drug market, man. That was the first big drug market the CIA cultivated, was their own American soldiers in Vietnam. It's no accident that so many of those Vietnam vets came back with drug problems. And they had Air America flying it from those hill country Hmong tribes and these others who were supposedly anti-Vietnamese, anti-communist, and they were our allies. I mean, that's a matter of public record, for Christ's sake. Senator Church's committee discovered that in the 70s. Congressman Otis Pike's Joint Congressional Committee in the late 70s. Senator Kerry's committee in the 80s about cocaine from Latin America. Again, the CIA involved. Heroin from Afghanistan. The CIA was involved with that. I know that. You know where I read it? I read it in a secret document. You know what the secret document was? The Washington Post. Right out there, flashed right out there on page 23, paragraph 42. It said, the CIA supported war is proving successful against the Soviets. The Mujahideen are coming back and taking over their lands. And with this, the opium trade has increased. And we can expect an increase in the heroin that has flooded in American cities. I said, wasn't that interesting? Just written like that, as if it was a weather report. Can you imagine if that was the Sandinistas doing that, or Libya, or Cuba? My God, it would have been all over the papers for years. Here it was on page 23, paragraph 45, as a couple of sentences. Now, this is all, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is all a matter of public record. Three congressional committees have had the guys come forward. Felix Rodriguez comes forward and before the Carey Committee and said, how much did you handle? He said, I handled about $10 million in cash a week. He said, who with? Senator Alphonse D'Amato. D'Amato's elegance and form and style. He says, wow, who with? What'd you do that with? Well, with the executive and military leaders of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, Venezuela, Mexico. D'Amato says, how'd you get out of those countries with that kind of money? How'd you get past customs? Really, Senator, when you're carrying $10 million, you don't go through customs. You know, they have limousines and helicopters waiting for you, and they say, I mean, I saw all this. I saw these guys get up and say, yeah, we got on these planes and we flew down there with guns. And then we loaded up with cocaine and we came back to the city. Came back to the U.S. The interesting slip there, the city. You know, I remember when cocaine was an upper class and upper middle class drug. I mean, it's what New York executives, Hollywood guys used and all that sort of thing. Coke was a chic and expensive recreational drug. Since it was people of a certain class, it was called the recreational drug. Suddenly, in the 80s, it appears on the streets in bargain prices in concentrated form as crack goes to all these different inner city people. And again, they want a African-American population that is not organized, getting militant, getting politically conscious as it was in the 60s with the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, Chicanos, the Brown Berets, all these different people. They don't want that. They want people who are disorganized, demoralized, drug-ridden, crime-ridden, young men who are not challenging the powers that be because they're too busy shooting each other up with guns and themselves up with needles. And so it worked very well. It also then gave them money to pursue their mercenary forces. This is a story that's been pretty much buried and killed in the media. Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News just this past year, again, after a year's investigation, this is journalism at its best. Found CIA operatives who said, yes, we worked with Crips and Bloods inner city leaders in L.A., brought the crack in there and took the money out for the CIA. He put all that on the internet, by the way. It got around so much. And look what the media did. They came out and saying, there's no evidence for it. There's never been any evidence for this. I mean, just outright blatant lies. Three congressional committees have given you all the evidence in the world. And the media comes in, and when their first line of suppression doesn't work, and the first line of suppression and distortion, the most common line, is omission. You just don't report it. When that doesn't work and the story gets out, gets on the internet, or some other thing happens, or there's demonstrations, or congressional committee decides to do this or then they come out and they destroy the target. And they say, Webb is not a particularly good journalist, this, that, and that. He has no evidence for it. He thinks the whole CIA, they accused him of having said things he never said. That's the way the media worked. Listen, if that kind of thing went on in some countries, that would be called totalitarian control. Senator Church found that every major news organization and outlet was penetrated by the CIA, that some 400 journalists, editors, and publishers were connected to the CIA. 400, that's a goodly number. There's a massive assault on government human services programs, and this has been given relatively little play in the media, except when it's doing the government's bidding. For instance, the word that's out is that certain things need reform. Welfare needed to be reformed. Now notice the use of certain terms, too, reform. These are the disinforming euphemisms that are used. Welfare wasn't reformed, it was savaged. It was destroyed. I mean, if I come over to your house and I say, you know, your house needs some rehabbing, needs a little reform, and then I level it with a bulldozer, I mean, wouldn't you be piqued? Wouldn't you feel deceived? And now we hear that same word again, Social Security. We've got to reform Social Security. Why, in 15 years, it'll be bankrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, I remember 1981 when Reagan was in office, and they said, in 15 years, Social Security will be bankrupt. It was running a surplus of $30, $40 billion then. It's still running a surplus today. Of course, they raised the Social Security tax, too. But the point is, it's at least 15 years later, it isn't bankrupt at all. It's 16 years later. It's not bankrupt. It's still running a surplus. It's a lie. But they convince people, they, from the beginning, say, well, this is going to happen, and therefore we've got to change it. The truth of the matter is that Social Security is a program that works, and it works very well, and it works for you too. You may think you're too young to worry about it, but when you're in your middle years and trying to raise your own family, do you want parents who are broke, or do you want parents who have some Social Security pension and some means of income for themselves? And Social Security is not just an old age pension. It has three components to it. It has old age retirement support. It has survivor's support. For any family of any age, if the breadwinner are killed, one or two, the people who are left destitute or indigent get Social Security. They can be 18 years old and they can collect Social Security. And the third component of it is disability. It has a disability insurance. If you're hit in an accident and you suffer disability and this puts a limit on your earning powers, you can collect Social Security. This is what they want to now dismantle. And the media is going along with it. The media begins by assuming the argument. The very thing that has to be argued and debated is already assumed. And they say, well, we all know that it needs reforming. We all know that it isn't working. It's working perfectly. In 50 years, they've never missed paying out a check. They handle $300 billion a year. And it means the difference between destitution and some measure of dignity for millions of elderly people and hundreds of thousands of disabled people. You'd never know that from the way the media treats that subject. One of the interesting things about the media personnel is the revolving door. They go from government to corporations, back to the media to government. Leslie Gelb was in corporate America, then he was in State Department, then he was at Washington Post, then he's at, I think he's Post, yeah. And now he's back in government. Diane Sawyer, she was with the Nixon administration, and now she's a media personality. She went off with Pat and Dick to California when he retired to help him write his memoirs. And now we see her on ABC. Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan was a columnist, a far right-wing columnist. Then he went in and became a speechwriter for the Nixon administration. Then he was out again as a commentator, journalist. And then he was in with the Reagan administration. And now he's out and he's a journalist again. So he's been either a journalist or a White House flack for his whole life. In other words, in his whole life, he's never had an honest job. Pete Williams. I remember Pete Williams. He was in that film I mentioned to you, Panama Deception, which I'm partial to because I'm in it too. I was being interviewed in that film, and Pete Williams kept coming on. Pentagon spokesman. Now, this is an objective journalist, right? The Pentagon spokesman would say, look, El Chorrillo neighborhoods in Panama have been bombed by U.S. planes, 3,000 people killed. He says, I have no evidence of that. We'd run, cut in and run footage, and you see these houses burning and all that, and the bodies lying there. I know of no such atrocities. Pete Williams leaves the Pentagon and he is now national correspondent for NBC. Now, if you had some other country where this was happening, where people were working 1 year for Pravda, the next year for the KGB, next year in the foreign ministry, the next year for Pravda again, well, you'd say, boy, they don't have an independent press. Boy, that's really totalitarian, isn't it? Right. Now, reporters fall into two kinds. When I wrote my book, Inventing Reality, I talked to reporters and interviewed some of them. There are those who will say to you, oh, yes, you have to have very finely attuned antenna as to just how far you could go, and if you go any further, they'll zap you. And then there are others, and usually those were ex-reporters. Those are ones who used to be with Associated Press, or used to do this, used to that, and they're no longer doing that. The other ones are the other 97% of the reporters I run into, and journalists and editors and such. They're the ones who get very indignant that you suggest that they are influenced by anything other than their own discerning, independent insight. You see, are you telling me that I'm not my own man? I'll have you know that in 20 years with this newspaper, I always said what I like, and I answered. You say what you like because they like what you say. And you have no sensation of being repressed because your views are perfectly coterminous with those of your boss. Your unexamined assumptions, your use of terms like reform and swamp rat and whatever else are exactly the kind of stuff they want to hear. It fits. Your ideological perspective is theirs. So you don't have any sensation of restraint. You know, if you have a leash around your neck, but you spend your whole life sitting by the peg, you don't feel restrained. It's only when you try to stray to a forbidden parameter that suddenly you feel the tug. As I felt, why, right on this very campus 25 years ago. Nicholas Johnson gives the case of the four stages of the socialization of a journalist. In stage one, the young, dedicated, idealistic reporter goes out and he investigates something and he writes this expose about local power guys who also happen to be big advertisers for the newspaper, and he comes back and he shows it to his editor, and the editor says, no, that's silly, we can't do that, no, that won't fly. Stage two, He doesn't go out and write it. He gets another idea about something that should be looked into, but he goes talk to the editor first, and the editor says, no, no, forget it. Forget that. Stage three, he gets the idea, and then he dismisses it himself and says, nah, nah, that's silly. And in stage four, he no longer gets the idea, no longer critically looks at that. And I added stage five. Stage five, he gets on panels with media critics like me and gets very indignant if I suggest that there are influences on him and all that. Well, if it's true that the news is so conservative and so serves the powers that be, why do conservatives keep attacking it as a liberal media? Why not? Keeps it on its toes, keeps it leaning to the right, dressing to the right, keeps it from going too far over to this side. Why not? Of course. And furthermore, for conservatives, for a far-right group, there are things that they don't want to see that are in the regular media. See, if the right-wing ideologues had their way completely, they would want the average newspaper to just be story after story, a celebration of the free market, the wonders and glories of free market capitalism, a few anti-communist horror stories, lots of crime in there, and then some cooking recipes, crossword puzzle, comics, and all that. Which, by the way, describes a lot of newspapers in America. We used to have one here that attacked me every other day. Burlington Free Press. Is it still around, the Burlington Free Press? We used to call it the Burlington Repress. They had a really terrible right-wing editor in those days named Frank Smith. He was the last editor in America to keep defending Richard Nixon before Nixon left the White House in disgrace for the Watergate thing. The New York Times would run his op-eds because they couldn't find anyone else willing to defend Nixon. That was Frank Smith. There's another problem conservatives do face. To some extent, the media does have to sometimes report hard news. Yeah, even their own ruling elites want to know some things that are going on. And when they report hard news, that gets them sort of close to the real world. And when they get close to the real world, you find that the real world is radical. The real world is leftist. It's not that we, leftists, make up these things. I don't mean that people out in the real world are radical or leftist. I mean the events that we talk about are real. It's not a leftist ideological argument that people are getting downsized and downgraded. It's the real world that's actually happening. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda view that the CEOs and the top 1% of the population are now enjoying a concentration of wealth that's 100% higher than it was 20 years ago. That happens to be an objective fact. We didn't make that up. We only discover it. It's the leftists who want to propagate it and want to publicize it a lot more. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda theme that children in Indonesia, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Haiti are working every day for 10, 12 cents an hour, 12 hours a day, that 300, 400 million children in the world are working, children in India, in the sex industry, in carpet industry, going blind, going lame, going every other thing without any kind of protections. That's not something we made up. That's something that the right will suppress because it reflects poorly on capital, and that's something that's real and it's out there. And to the extent that the media ever takes notice of a toxic waste dump or something like that, or waste in the Pentagon or something like that, that's when the conservatives say, you see, it's a liberal conspiracy to make corporate America look bad. That's terrible. You shouldn't be talking about those things. And you must talk about them probably because you're a leftist or a liberal. No, they mention it every so often because that's reality. Reality is radical. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up there. Let me just add that one last question that inevitably comes up. So tell me, Parenti, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? I mean, do you feel there's this small group of people who are plotting this whole thing? I mean, don't you think the force of circumstances, institution, market necessity, that makes things happen? And do you think they actually plan? Do you think there's a small group of men sitting around in a room plotting all this stuff? Somehow that image is supposed to be the most devastating one. That's the one where you're supposed to shrink back and say, oh. They, oh, no, no, no. They don't sit around in a room. they meet on carousels and they go up and down on horses and talk. Or they jump out of airplanes, and as they're free falling, they talk about it. What about a merger? What about? Of course they meet in rooms. Where the hell else do you think they meet? Of course they meet in rooms. They got lots of rooms. There are rooms in the White House. There are rooms at General Motors. There are rooms at the Bohemian Grove where they go. There are rooms at the Council for Foreign Relations. There are rooms at the Trilateral Commission meetings. There are rooms at the Bilderberg Conference. I looked at the roster list, you know, 1989. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist. I was looking at 1988 or so, the Bilderberg Conference. Now, this is an international conference of all the elites of various countries, the financial and political elites. Isn't that interesting how economics and politics, the leaders, always seem to get together? There's no conspiracy. Oh, no, no, no. But they just happen to go to the same spas and places. And so, of course, I immediately turn to the U.S. page, and I see the first name on the U.S. delegation list is a representative from Rockefeller Brothers Association, David Rockefeller. And the next name on the list puzzled me. I'd never seen it before. It was Honorable Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas. And I said, what the hell is the governor of Arkansas doing at the Bilderberg Conference? Who is this guy? I didn't know much about Clinton. I knew he had used the National Guard and sent him down to Honduras and all that. Well, you know what happened less than a year and a half later? Why, suddenly the corporate media was saying front runner for the Democratic nomination, Bill Clinton. Interesting. Just a little morsel I want you to be intrigued by. Yes, they do consciously conspire to advance their own interests. You do. School teachers organize and try to get a better deal and try to understand what the policies are, what their options are, what their possibilities are. Farmers organize and do that. The minute you suggest that the ruling elites, the guys who own most of the capital, most of the land, practically all the technology, and control almost all the labor in this country, the minute you suggest that they might be concerned about their interests and try to advantage themselves and propagate it, someone says, well, you got a conspiracy theory? You consciously pursue your self-interest. You wonder about what courses I should take, what should I do this summer, where should I live, can I get that job, this, that, the other thing. What makes you think they don't consciously, willfully pursue their interests and pursue the operational power that is needed to ensure and advance their interests as ruthlessly as they have to? Not directly. They hire people to do the dirty work for them. Well, what is to be done? You know, there's an awful lot to do. You as an individual maybe can do very little, but you can join with others. You can join and work with Spark to help advance and educate and agitate. You can support alternative media. There are a few small radio stations that carry alternative perspectives. There's about 78 of the 9,000 radio stations in America. There's about 78 that are willing to carry my talks now. Support alternative publications like the Monthly Review, Covert Action Quarterly, People's Weekly World, Multinational Monitor, various public interest groups have their own newspapers or newsletters. Peace groups have both important vital information. There's a local alternative newspaper right out here in the back. I'm sorry, Robin, the name escapes me, but it's
Toward Freedom.
Okay, Toward Freedom. And that's right out there, and you can start educating yourself. You can challenge the mainstream media with letters to the editor, calls to the editors and publishers, call in to radio talk shows. I do that. It's getting harder and harder. In the last maybe 15, 20 years, I've had about 5 letters in the Washington Post and about 4 in the New York Times and 2 op-eds in the New York Times, 1 op-ed in the LA Times, and rather limited issues or questions too, but something. And now it's gotten in the last 5 years, it's harder and harder. But you can still call up and you can still write. And even if they don't run it, they often get worried when they get too much info. When you see something really egregious and deceptive in that way, and above all, we can organize, agitate, educate, and create alternative political movements. George Bush called that class war, when we start to criticize the rich and powerful, abuse us and human labor and the environment. He calls that class war. See, whenever we fight back, whenever ordinary people fight back, we're called waging class war. They're doing class war all the time on our heads. The minute we fight back against it, they go, oh, that's class war. You're being divisive, and you mustn't do that. Yeah, divisive. Just like rebellious slaves were being divisive. That they were being divisive. They were disrupting the beauty and harmony of the magnolia piece of the plantation. And that's us, folks. You can call that class war, this fighting back, this agitating. But I have another word for it also. It is class war, but it's something else. When people act as the active social agents of their own lives, I have another word for that. That's called democracy. Democracy, democracy, and let's have more of it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.